Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
That's you two singing City of Blinding Lights. Now, you know her as Bev from Churchbridge, Saskatchewan. She joins us this morning. So, first of all, Bev, welcome to the on-air side of All Marine Radio. How are you?
I'm well, Mike. Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. This has been a long time coming. Before, though, we finally talk about you and post-traumatic winning and how it's impacted your life, we first got to find out about you a little bit and then how you came to us, because we're not supposed to really cross paths in life. We don't have, right? You're not organically from our tribe, although you've lived a parallel life to many of us. So let's talk about you. Born and raised where?
Small town in southeastern Saskatchewan named Arcola. It's about, I don't know, have you been to Estevan?
Are you kidding me? Ask me how many times I moved the cone that was the
right.
that was the border crossing. Once they left, they put an orange cone in the middle of the highway, and that was the right thing to prohibit you from crossing the United States and Canadian border, which it slowed down nobody. And
it doesn't.
So yeah,
it doesn't matter where you cross, what border crossing, it's sort of the same thing.
Really?
Still, Arcola is 60 miles south. I don't know, north east of Estevan.
Okay. So, but yeah, there's still only orange cones?
Well, no. It depends on the one you go through. I often go through North Portal, which goes straight down number 9. And yeah.
Right.
Because Estevan, I would have to go further west.
Right. I've been through Portal as
well. Because I'm on the east side.
Got it. Yeah. Got it. All right. So you're born there.
Yes.
And what do your parents do? Is your dad in agriculture?
No. Oh, train.
We've heard about it.
I know. That's hauling crude oil to the east.
God bless them.
Yes. Well, God, we worry about it when it goes through town because, if there's a derailment, we have houses all along the tracks.
You know, Minot had a derailment, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
In the middle of the night. And this is the thing that, you know, in terms of public safety, kind of interesting little sidebar here.
Yes.
Most radio stations are now automated. So the overnight DJ is not there. So this train derails with toxic chemicals in Minot, and this cloud begins to form, and they're calling radio stations, and there's nobody there. And they can't get a hold of anybody. And this thing blossoms. And now, thank God, it went you know, it went vertical into this air and did not dissipate horizontally. But they had a very big to-do about it because, you know, the everything was shut off and there wasn't people available and, you know, the emergency responders couldn't get a hold of anybody. So, I mean, if in theory it would have gone kind of flat and horizontal, this gas cloud, people probably would have been dead that didn't have to be in a day and age when somebody has to hit a button, everybody's cell phone gets a message and things like that. So no, it's any city that has trains that go through it, it's a pretty serious matter, eh?
Yeah. Well, we're in a small town, like we don't have quite 800 anymore. But when Alberta started to send the crew to the Quebec and Ontario that want it but won't allow the pipeline.
There you go.
The CN came, or we're on the CP line. And they came to a public meeting.
Which is what? Canadian Pacific and
CN? Pacific.
CN is Canadian Northern?
Canadian National. But there is sort of a dual.
Right.
We're on the Canadian Pacific line, the northern part. The main one goes through Regina and Calgary, but we're north of that.
Got it.
And so they came to a public meeting and they explained the procedure, like what to do, what not to do. And the concern is now, if you can see the tracks, and I can't in the summer because of all the foliage, because I'm about a block and a half away. If you see the cars going east, then you know they're full. So then you always hope, I hope they get through town without a derailment.
Right.
When you see them going west, you know they're empty. So they're heading them back up to Edmonton because we're on the line that goes from Winnipeg, Saskatoon, Edmonton, and then, of course, that's where they load, I guess, the crude that comes from the tar sands.
Right. So, there you have it. Everybody get a little bit of
railroad
economics and history from Central Canada.
Yeah, when we used to have only grain cars and then a lot of container cars, now it's basically the crude and it's constant.
Alberta is the, for those of you that are hockey fans, the Edmonton Oilers, that would be where that name comes from. I'm not sure where the Calgary Flames come from. Do you know why they're the Flames?
I have no idea. Unless it's their tower that they have there. Maybe it's a reference to all the oil and gas. Flames from those. Because we have a lot of that, like the Bakken Field.
Right.
That's also in Saskatchewan.
Right.
Yeah.
Saskatchewan is most famous for?
Well, most people would say being flat and really fields. Like it's a lot of canola. Like in wheat, that's what it was farming. But now the southern part for years has been also for oil. But there's a downturn in that economy. So.
Right. Yeah. The Russians and the Saudis put it to everybody here this last year. When you drive from where I lived in North Dakota and you drive into Saskatchewan, it is this vast plain. It is the extension of the Great Plain into Canada. And it's like an ocean of dirt. But again, it starts in South Dakota. It starts in Iowa. It starts in, you know, it starts in Nebraska. All that incredible farmland. I mean, just because there's a border there, the earth didn't really get the memo, and it just extended itself as far as it would go. And but it's vast. When you're on the Transcan Highway.
Trans-Canada.
And there you go. You wave at people when they go the other way because there's not sometimes there's not so many people out there. But no, it's a beautiful country. And the people are absolutely like small-town America, small-town Canada. My sons played hockey up there. They're some of the nicest people you ever meet and give you the shirt off their back as long as you don't kick their ass in hockey. So that's the way that shit works. So tell me, what did your dad do?
Okay. My dad actually worked for an oil company.
Oh,
I guess when I was a kid, he worked in the garage. But then
what is that? Graph.
Well, he started in the 60s, about 1961, his neighbor started working for Tidewater Oil, and that was an American oil company.
Right.
And they were starting to do some exploration in southern Saskatchewan at that time. Uh-huh. And his neighbor got him on a job. But my dad drove trucks, so he hauled casing to the different sites, well sites.
Got it. All right. And so you grew up there, and then where do you graduate from grade 12?
Oh, Arcola. I was in Arcola from birth until the end of grade 12.
Got it.
And then that was it. I was 17 when
I noticed how I flipped to Canadian without any problem. I already dropped A once, and then I said grade 12 as opposed to graduated from high school. So,
well, you should, because that's the correct way to say it.
Yeah, well, we all know that, right? So, so you graduate from high school, and then do you go to college? What do you do with your life?
Yeah, I then went to the university in Regina. I just took whatever came first.
Oh, really?
Not a way to plan your career, but I was 17, and I remember it was about January of that. Well, I think one day in grade 12, they gave us a sheet to fill out, and that would give you an idea of what you might be good at.
Right.
And then I thought, teaching might be easy. And I realized after all the years that I taught that it was easy because the teacher had good discipline in the room.
Oh, well, but it does work like that,
Yes. So my mom said, now, it's about time you apply for something. So, when you graduated in 1970, women typically were a nurse, a steno, or a teacher, or a mother. Right. There weren't that many.
Right.
Not too many went past that.
No, the bra burning stage had just begun, and
yes.
The ripples had not, they were only being right. The smoke fumes from the bras burning were still in the air, and so mm-hmm. Most kids would hear that, like, well, we took an aptitude test and they told us we would be good at it. Kids would look at you now like, what are they talking about?
Right.
Oh, well, you used to take – it wasn't like, what do you want to be, Joey? It was, yeah, this is what you're good at. You might want to go into the trades, or, you might want to become a salesman or a lawyer or a doctor because, your aptitude is high. So there was a day when you took tests, and most of that stuff was closed to women. And so that's kind of the tail end of that era, though, right, Beth? I mean, people that would come after you, I mean, the world begins to change at that point, and with it, Saskatchewan as well. Did you become a teacher?
Yes, and only because they accepted me first. I put in an application. I knew I didn't want to be a nurse because I had done candy striping as a high school student. And every time somebody coughed and the door was closed, I thought they were going to die. Oh. So I knew I didn't want that. And so I put in an application for Regina, where there was a secretarial school, and I put in an application to the University of Saskatchewan. It was called Saskatchewan at that time, Regina Campus. And I said to my mother, whatever comes first, that's what I will be. Not a good way to choose a career.
No, what the hell? Why not? I mean, look, it just pointed you in a direction. If you didn't like it, you certainly would have stayed, I don't think. But
yes.
But funny. I mean, let me tell you, there's people that have gone on and, I mean, like, why did you go there? Well, this happened and this happened and it came in the mail and so I went. And sometimes it doesn't have to be that complicated.
Yes. All right. Well, she was happy I chose that because she always wanted to be a teacher. So that's what I did. Now, at that time in Saskatchewan, and I'm not sure what year it changed, if you went into elementary education, it was a 2-year program.
Right.
And the first year was basically, arts and sciences. And the second year you took all, because as an elementary teacher, you have to be able to teach every subject. So then your classes then pertain to the subjects. So we had a social studies class, a science, how to teach math, etc. And then you had two practicals that you went for 3 weeks. You went out to a rural school, and I chose Carlisle, which was 10 miles from Arcola, and just drove and did that. And then you had to do once in the city for 3 weeks. And then you were given your, what they call the standard A. So when I came out, people were still coming out with the standard A, so that we're doing elementary. After a few years, the salary for standard A was the lowest. And so I thought, I want to make more money. So I then started on my degree slowly. I was teaching then, and so I did night school and summer school, and that was basically in the 80s. From 82 to 89, my whole focus was on my work and university classes. So then my salary went up about $15,000 a year.
Whoa.
There was a big difference because it's a graduated salary. Like the salary is a 10-step one. The first year you get, and then the second year experience, you get more and more. And, you know.
So what do you, what happens now? You're making a ton of money. Now what? Then what?
Making a ton of money. Yeah. What, teaching?
Yes.
Well, then I just, I went teaching, and I was fortunate that the principal at that time, I think, stepped in for me, because most of the classes I could get in Yorkton, or a friend that I met the first day of university, she was a teacher. I stayed at her place in the summer, but the last four, I couldn't get them in Yorkton, so I had to be on campus. And I thought, how am I going to do this? Like, I can't just quit in May. But I think the principal helped me out, and the school division gave me 75% of my salary and let me go off to university in May and June.
Wow, that's a good deal. That's a good deal.
Yeah, so
well
I had
done.
Four classes to do. Yeah.
And so you finished there, and then
with a degree in reading.
And with a degree in reading, and then what do you become?
I became then what I had been all along. I was still a teacher. I just was making more money, and I learned a lot about reading, teaching reading by doing that.
Right.
And so then I just, in the fall, I was back into my same classroom. I think I was teaching grade six at that time, and I just went back into my grade six classroom and stayed there. Well, moved around from grade three to grade six until I retired after 30 years.
Wow. Talk to me about some of the other things you get involved with. At one point, you're working with the police department. Tell me about some of the other things you do in your life.
Okay. As a student, I did candy striping when I was at school, and I always liked to volunteer for things. I mean, when Mom worked at the arena, I liked to work in the kitchen. There were some old ladies, I guess they were old ladies, homemakers group, and there were a couple of us that we all would always help them out there. And if I joined something, I usually was a president or a secretary or treasurer. Like, I just like to be involved. Then as teaching was very busy, but we had, there was a group. Well, we belong to the Saskatchewan Teachers Federation, so there's a liaison group in each school, district, division, and you needed a representative from each school, and the staff said, we need one. How about you do it? I said, I'm new here. What about the rest of you? Oh, you'll meet new people. Go, Bev.
There you go.
Well, they were too lazy to go. So anyways, I went, and the first meeting I was at, actually the president of the group was a woman, and I remember sitting there, Mac, and thinking, I wonder if I could do that job. Now, that was 20, and then I stayed with that group, and I was busy with that group. So that was like meetings at night or after school once a month for 20 years. And for 5 different years, I was the president. And I did secretary and treasurer. So, like, I always took that kind of leadership role. So that was sort of all related to school. Something that I did that was totally different, and I loved it, was I was secretary treasurer of the senior hockey club. the first year I was here, I ended up.
And here is Churchbridge.
Yeah, Church. Yeah, in Churchbridge, I moved to Churchbridge in 1975 to teach. I was hired to teach grade 5, and I started the. I'm sounding stupid. When I was in Wawota teaching, that was my first 3 years I taught in Wawota. And it's just between Arcola and Churchbridge. And they divided the salary into 12. So you get a yearly salary, and each month you received a portion of it. So at the end of June, you would receive like 3 months' portion.
Right.
Well, when I came for the interview here, I never even thought of asking about money. Like, what did I know? I was 19. I thought, huh? Right. I guess it'll be the same. So I, at the end of June, I received 1 month's salary. I thought, what am I going to do for 2 months? I'm certainly not moving home to be with my mother. So I went to the local bar to see if they had a job. And she said, no, we don't. Then, but as luck would have it, the office clerk at the local co-op, she said, Bev, I'm going on holidays. How would you like to do my job for the summer? But what would I do? Well, you post bills and that. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. A week after I started that, so that would be Tuesday to Saturday, 9 to 6, the bar phone and said, how would you like to work for us? We have an opening now. So I then worked from the bar. Well, one night there, two of the guys said, what are you doing next year? So I was working all summer. And I said, I don't know. He said, are you leaving? And I said, no, I'm sticking around. So my dad and mom are quitting their job with the hockey club. How would you like to be secretary treasurer? Well, so I accepted. I said, what would I do? Don't worry about it. Well, I know I could do it. I basically then, they played hockey. The coach coached, and Bev took care of everything else because they knew I would.
Six years
of that.
There you go. Tell me about...
Victim services.
Yeah, tell me. You got involved with victim services.
Yes, so I was busy with all that. But then when I started the university classes, I had to pass over the hockey club because it was on the classes in York number Tuesdays and Thursdays, and that was basically the home games in Churchbridge. So in 1994, the summer of 94, Yorkton had an exhibition, and I thought, I'll just go in and buy some mini donuts or something there. And just inside the main gate, there was a table, and on it, it said Parkland RCMP, Parkland Victim Services. So I just stopped.
Tell everybody what, first of all, if you ever want to eat good food, just go into any small town that's having a hockey game because they bring it from their houses. It's unbelievable, okay? Just take my advice. Don't ask any questions. You see a hockey game going on in rural Canada, pull in just to eat, okay? To hell with the hockey, eat the food. What does RCMP stand for?
Okay, Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
All right.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, except for some of our cities in Canada, they are the police force in small town, rural, like in Saskatchewan. Regina and Saskatoon both have their own city police, as do a couple of other cities. But all the small towns, you pay them to patrol. Yorkton has a city RCMP. They also have this rural area, they're also there. And then because Yorkton is the larger city for the east central part of Saskatchewan, they also have the... commissioned officers that do, sort of take care of a larger area. So that's what RCMP stands for.
Okay. And so how did you become a volunteer with them?
Well, I stopped at the table and I thought, oh, RCMP, I wouldn't want to have been one, but I was always curious. So I stopped and I talked to a guy named Robert and I said, I was kind of interested. And he said, well, take this application, fill it out. Mail it in and then wait and see. Victim Services was in its first, they were the first ones in Victim Services. It had just started in 93. So I filled it out. I received in August, I was heading off to Regina to see Les Mis. And I stopped to get the mail and I received a letter that said, you're accepted, come into the detachment, there will be a meeting. And then I had an interview. Because they want, then I was accepted as a volunteer, we had then, so we couldn't start right away. We had 40 hours of training, and the training was in, we had to learn about the criminal justice system, how to work with victims, you know, just everything, you know, that we might need.
Right.
And then we had 40 hours of that, and then we became, you know, as long as they considered us worthy, then we were accepted into victim services. And at that time, you had to give 3 hours a week to victim services. Like, it was all volunteer.
Right.
And I chose Friday night because I live 35 miles from Yorkton, and, I was teaching. So that was 1994. And there was another woman there. She was from the first class, and we became good friends. And so I worked Friday nights. And then we did the on-calls Friday nights, and then it went from there. And Victim Services is an advocacy for victims of crime and trauma. And we are the workers are the first ones that anybody sees after sort of they've been traumatized, other than the police, or if it was a house fire, you know, the fire department appears and ambulance takes you to the hospital. But we're basically first responders.
So is that the first time in your life that you get to see traumatic events that involve other people on a regular basis?
Oh, Mac, it opened my eyes to the world. Like and I started, now I think it was about the middle of October when we became official workers. So I started my Friday nights, and then it's like you go in and the other one guides me. We were working on files and RCMP files. And then I thought, well, when would we ever get a call? Well, one night, I still remember my reaction. Over the radio comes, because we were just in a little room off of where the stenos were, is one of the members. Now, RCMP, you call them members. Like, they're constables, corporals, etc., but you refer to them as members. One of the members over the radio says, there's been an accident. I need victim services at the hospital, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I can hear your dog.
Yep. I don't know what exactly is going on, but I'm sure it's something.
Well, that's all right.
Extremely exciting for either Jack or Joe.
Yeah.
One of those two buttheads.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then I thought, okay, better get to the washroom. My heart, Mac, was pounding. Because I thought, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And because it was a 85-year-old woman that had walked at night in front of the car and been killed, my partner said, we need to call in two other workers because there's a good chance there's going to be two families to deal with. So we did that, and we then proceeded to go to the hospital and met up with the other workers. And that, and they split up. One of the other workers came with me, and she said, come with me. We will go, and we will be with the driver. We typically never worked with people who were guilty of something, but he was still traumatized. So
right.
Until the RCMP say, nah, you know, you're not allowed to work with them anymore. We were allowed. So it was all new to me. Like, I didn't know what to say, really, even though I'd been trained. And she started talking, and then all of a sudden she says, well, I think I'll go be with Robert. And I'm left there with this young, I don't know, 20-something-year-old. And I'm thinking, what do I say? But all of a sudden the words just came.
So how many years do you do that for?
I did it almost 14. So it was every Friday night, and then lots of on-calls. And with victims of, rape, accidents, a lot of abuse.
If you, in looking back at that, what did you learn? I mean, I talk about, you know, one of the, you know, great epiphanies for me in doing post-traumatic winning is the amount of child abuse and sexual violence that is resident in our culture and certainly in the United States military and the Marine Corps. As you look back on your time as a volunteer, what would you say your chief takeaway was?
Oh, the amount, like the abuse that, like in my world, it wasn't a part of my world. Right. You know, the number of people that are abused. And then the hardest was dealing with the children. You know, so it's basically the same thing because it's just a mirror of society.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Now you deal with health issues, and but mm-hmm. before I talk about that, I want you to explain to everybody how you cross paths with All Marine Radio. How does this most unlikely of relationships begin? What do you see? How do you hear? What happened?
Should I actually name the person that?
Yeah, I think.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Because it was a Marine. Actually, in 2016, in September, my friend Edward died. And I was kind of lost. So I was on Facebook, and all of a sudden one night up pops this friend request, and it was somebody in a uniform. And I thought, I have nothing to do. We'll find out what's going on. So I clicked on it. Right away, there was a reply. And the person's, and I thought, well, that's not a Canadian military uniform. It has to be American. So the person was impersonating him, and he used the name John Allen.
That's right.
So he used John Allen. So, of course, I clicked on this John Allen, and it said, yes, he was John Allen, and he lived in Arizona, and he had a son. That was the information on it. And so then I thought, okay, so I love to Google. So I Googled John Allen's name, and luckily he used that name. And unfortunately for General Allen, I found out that what he was doing, and he had actually used this 3-star photo, like, you know, with this 3-star uniform.
Yes. Yes.
And but he had used the name John Allen. So then I found out, of course, you know, he didn't have a son, and et cetera, et cetera. And this character on the other end, I would almost think in the end was from one of the African nations, said, so what do you do? He said, well, I'm commanding in Afghanistan. Now, this was 2016.
Right.
And, of course, I had read then, you know, then I thought, well, I got to find out about John Allen. And so I knew, you know, everything he was saying wasn't true because he was already out by then. And so then he, every so often, he would appear or disappear. I'd be on at night and his name would pop up. So then I'd try and trick him up if I could, because then I knew facts, but he was sticking with the story. And then all of a sudden he would say, oh, got to go and look after my troops. So anyways, this went on for a while. So then I assumed it was a he. And then one day he says, do you want to meet my son? And I thought, okay. So I probably assume it was him pretending to be a son, and the son was supposedly, I said, so he said, my son's in school in Africa. And so I asked him what level he was at. And he said, and I knew, I said, well, what time is it there? And what he told me, I assumed then he had to have been in Africa because, I mean, our family, my dad's family and all from England. And I knew the time England was ahead of us at that time. And so he obviously was in Africa. So he pretended to have this. Well, eventually it ended up, well, I need money. I said, well, you work.
Shocker.
Yeah.
Nobody,
you work. You
nobody,
have money.
Nobody saw that coming.
Yeah, well, the kid says, I need money because it's my birthday and I need to, I want to buy things. And I said, if it's your birthday, all your school friends should be buying you stuff. So he, I said, no. I said, I'm not going to. So then I started to ask questions of this character. I said, I wrote in and I had found out the name of General Allen's daughters. And I just wrote in these two names and he said, what do you mean? So, I mean, it caught him up. And eventually I said, like, look it. If you're going to scam somebody, like, get it right.
Nice.
Yeah, I said, my friend said, like, why would you give him that advice? I said, well, he's too stupid to probably understand it anyways.
There you go.
My sarcasm there. Anyway, so then that was the end of that. And then I was still, so the one day when I checked, General Allen, and up popped on Google a conversation with an all-marine radio. So that was, and so I thought, okay, I'm curious. And I had always been interested in, not that I would want to be in the military, but as a kid I was, well, from the time when I lived, you know, that was the in the early 50s, the, you know, Francis the Talking Mule.
We don't need to go there. I have nightmares about that jackass.
I know, with the plebes, you know, it was always West Point movies. I liked that. I watched things like with my dad like that. And then the one that I watched one summer, I was enthralled. They were marching, but they didn't have those same uniforms on. And it was a story of John Philip Sousa.
A fine, fine member of the United States Marine Corps. Yes.
And I watched all the marching. And no, Bev has gone off on a track. Get me back on.
No, how you come across All Marine Radio.
Right,
so,
yes.
So you listened to that. You listened to that interview.
I listened to your first interview with him.
And
I think that was the first, yeah.
Why did you keep listening?
Because I thought what you were talking about was interesting. And when you were speaking, I think that was the first interview you had done with General Allen. And he was talking about his life, and then he mentioned the Marshall Plan, and I thought, I learned about that in grade 12 social studies. I didn't know that was a person that did it.
Right.
And then why I've kept listening is because I like listening to intelligent people.
Could you say
and
that?
I learned
Could
a
you
lot.
Say that again, please, a little bit louder?
Well, I was referring to General Allen. No, I wasn't. I like listening to intelligent conversations. And I like learning things. So that's why I just hung in there. And then I guess what else sort of hung me in there, and I thank you because you kind of put some purpose back in my life, is that I don't know when was it, maybe in May. One time your post didn't have sound or something. And I thought, I wonder if he knows that. Okay, Bev, you don't need to tell him. And then I thought, no, what if he doesn't know it? So I would tell you when you had screwed up.
I would get these emails and I'd be like, God damn it. Like, what did I do wrong this time? So that was how Bev and I meet. And, and she continues to do quality assurance for All Marine Radio to this day. So 2016, I mean, that's right when it started.
Well, 2000.
Go ahead.
Sorry, 2017, though, was when I connected in. But, yes, it was about a year after you had started.
All right. So then I start going down this trail of post-traumatic winning.
Mm-hmm.
And like many people, I don't know that I'm speaking to you, right, and these interviews are speaking to you. Talk to me about that experience, because I find it very interesting as people who have listened, you know, we all have our own experiences in life. I mean, I talk about mine and but everybody listening has their own as well. And sometimes it doesn't occur to me, how deeply and profoundly the ideas and the voices in post-traumatic winning resonate with people. And you're one of those people. So talk about when you began to hear that, Bev, and its impact in your life.
Okay. Well, I guess I listened to all the podcasts. It was when you and Josh and Gunnar went to Lejeune in January of 2019. And it was at that time that it was really interesting listening, because things made sense to me, but I still was like, poor Bev, you've got all these issues. And so I was just listening sort of, you know, under that. Those were my thoughts. But I'm going to tell you today the podcast that changed my life. And I went through your podcast under the resources tab.
Right.
You know, the post-traumatic winning podcast.
Right.
And I don't think this one is there, and I think this one should be there because of what you talked about. And the podcast was from January 10th of 2019, And it is post-traumatic winning thoughts after 3 days with the 2nd Marine Division. And it was you and Gunner and Josh, as you had done on other ones.
Right.
But the difference with this one is what you were talking about.
What were we talking about?
Okay.
Let me tell you, it was such a, that week, life-changing experience for me, certainly. And because I had worked, I had lived this, and then I had talked about it, and then it occurred to me that maybe you could use this stuff to do something about it. And so then General Furness opens a door to do that. But, I didn't know. I thought it would be – I have a pretty good instinct for the ear of the common human being. They're my people. And so – but, there's always that uncertainty is when, now we're going to go play in Peoria and we're going to see what people say. And from the very first time that I did it, and that time I was doing it with Josh and Mike, the impact was absolutely, I don't even know how to articulate it. It was life-changing to see the emotional response of so many people and how deeply it resonated with them and all of that. And I think I would even tell you, if I recollect, you can hear it in our voices, how deeply that we were all moved.
Yeah.
So that's my recollection. Give me yours.
Okay. Well, I even marked the, I listened to it again this afternoon.
Holy and shit.
It's such a good one. Well, they're all good, but it was at about 38 minutes in, and you started to speak about Major General Furness's comments, and they were related to his daughter. Now, this is the part that I think everybody should hear that, plus what I'm going to say next. That's why I suggest this podcast go into that list. And then Josh cut in and he said, I'm just going to read the words if you don't mind. There is a process of grieving about what you thought would be. And I had dealt with a lot of grief with victim services because we did a lot of deaths, accidents, whatever. But I never really associated that word with anything other than something related to death, as I think probably so many do. So I was hearing it differently that day. Grieving the loss of the life you had hoped or expected in favor of the one you are having is a critical part of being able to accept and coexist with this stuff. And I thought, oh my God, that's what I have to do.
Because how many minutes into the interview is that?
Okay, you started at about 38:15.
Okay. All right. So we don't need to hear Bev narrate it. You can hear it, and here it is, as long as her numbers are right.
Yes. I listened today, and I thought it was.
Here you go.
Furness, listening, not only seeing a story, but his lingo.
Let me just say something. This is the story that he told yesterday, and he told today, and he told again tonight. Is a story about Dave and his wife, Linda, have a daughter that's developmentally disabled. And they found out about that when she was 4. And the way they find out is Dave's at home, his wife's at her parents in Richmond. Dave's writing a paper that he had put off too long and had to devote the whole weekend to it. And the doctor called up and was going through the tests. And he walks you through the way he was notified that, his daughter would always be in their care, and what that felt like as a parent, and then having to get in the car and drive down to tell his wife. And it's an emotional event when he talks about it. And I don't know how many people have come up to you and mentioned it, but I've had at least a half dozen people walk up and said, "I've never seen a general officer do that." And we who are his friends, you know, I've heard that story before. But just when he and I are sitting around talking, and you're sitting there watching somebody you know, he and I are battle buddies times three and have served together, you know, another time. And we're great friends. And to see your friends show that kind of courage and selflessness is the stuff that, you know, you hear us talk about that we see in combat all the time. And now you see him doing it. And what he's trying to do is, as Mike said earlier, set an example. So as he unburdens himself, every one of those Marines looks at him and said, if he can do it, you know, I can talk about it too. And it's just, that's what we've kind of been witnessing, and that's how absolutely cool it's been.
And he used a word tonight that has come up in some other settings. Certainly when we talk about grief, we associate it with death, with loss of life. And he talked about having to grieve really the delta between the life he had hoped for his daughter and the life she was going to live. And he had to come to grips with some of those things, that she wouldn't walk down the aisle and go to college and some of these other things. And there's a process of grieving, the loss of what you thought would be. And I just think it's one of those, and I'm trying to put my doctor hat on, but when you can give language to things you're experiencing, is this notion of grieving the loss of the life you had hoped or expected in favor of the one you're having is a critical part of being able to accept and coexist with this stuff. It's accepting it for what it is, but being gentle with yourself in the process, because when you say grief, that's heavy. And that's what he used, because he was speaking to just how heavy that was for him at that time as he went through that experience.
There you have it, Bev.
Yeah, and that's why I say this one has to be there.
So tell me about so that impacts you how, in that you cope with your 14 years of volunteering, you know, in traumatic events, you know, and they happen over and over and over, right? And
right.
And then you're supposed to, I mean, you're a good Canadian girl, you're supposed to shoulder it up, right, and keep going, and you know, you have people that depend on you, you're a teacher, you have responsibilities. You're supposed to, you know, move on and be okay. But clearly that's not easy. So what do you conclude after you, or is that just the beginning of a discussion that you begin to have with yourself?
Well, at that point, I didn't think of my experiences with victim services, even though there's some that, you know, I can still vividly remember, but it was what I was dealing with health-wise is with my lymphedema, and the fact that that was 3 years at that time that I had leg ulcers, and the leg was getting bigger, and it was just like a cycle of, like, is this ever going to go away? It can't go away, and my mobility had changed, my whole life had changed, and I hated where I was, but I couldn't control it. And when I heard that grieving, what you had hoped, and I thought, that is the way out for me. I have to do that. So that percolated in my head over the weekend. That was a Thursday interview over the weekend. And I didn't realize that it had started to change me until the next Thursday when my home care nurse came. Should I continue?
Yes.
Okay.
You continue till you hear me yell, okay?
Okay, because I do talk a lot.
It's all right. I always
waited in the kitchen for her, and she used to come every once a week, and I thought, I am sick of her coming once a week, because every week it reminded me of where I was at in my life that I hated. And so I said, can't you do twice a week, bring supplies twice a week? So she agreed. And I was always in the kitchen waiting for her. She would come in the front door. And that day, for some reason, she stood in the doorway of the kitchen. And she said, what's the matter with you? I said, nothing. I'm just waiting for you. She said, something's happened. I said, I don't know. She said, you're different. What have Mac and Gunnar been talking about? Because she knew I listened to you.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because when she would come, I'd often be listening. And I said, well, nothing. But then I showed her, then I had received an email from you. You had replied to one of mine, and I have it stuck up on my fridge. And I said, I've listened to this, and it was talking about grief and grieving. But I couldn't see the change in myself. Like, I couldn't feel it then, but she could see it. And I'm thinking, like, what did you see? She said, you just look different. Now, I then became quite peaceful with what had where I was. I didn't, it was like the end of, like, poor me. Like, come on, Bev, people have it worse off.
Right.
But, I mean, you use that trauma is trauma. And so then I would think of people that had, I considered worse trauma than me. And yet this is traumatic when your life totally changes and you're using a walker and, you know, you're not 80 years old. So then I started to listen to some of your interviews. And I think the first one I listened after that was Charlie Linville. That did the Everest one.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
And then some of the different ones where, you know, I mean, you've got one limb missing, two limb missings, whatever. Okay. And the guy you were talking about not long ago, the one that did all those with two prosthetic legs, was doing the mini marathons, a day.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, Bev, there are people that are worse off than you. And I know that because I had an aunt with cerebral palsy. And then I started to think, well, I shouldn't be complaining. And yet, you know, this is traumatic. So that's how it really affected me. And I became peaceful, really peaceful. And because I wasn't born to be a thin person, you know, I didn't have that kind of metabolism. And so then I would be I used food. And I always said to people, I wish I was an alcoholic. I mean, this is so stupid, but I wish I was an alcoholic because you don't have to have alcohol in your house and yet you have to have food. Now, yes, you can have the right food, but if you use food to deal with whatever is bothering you, you can creatively make anything.
Right.
And but I then became, you sent me an email and one part of it said, could I read this email?
Sure.
It's just a quick little one. It was the first one that I received.
I'm thinking, and I think, holy shit, what
What did I say? Okay.
And when I say, oh, sure, I'm thinking, good God, what the hell did you write? Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, it said, I had written about my reality since 2015. So this is what we're just talking about now. And it's the first line, it will only get better. Candor is cleansing and a step towards a better life. The next line was, so eat right, with an exclamation point. Take care of yourself because I don't need to lose my QA person with 22 exclamation points.
See, it's always got to wind up being about me ultimately.
Yeah, and then the third one was, the more you reach out, the lighter your burden will be. I know that. And at that point, I didn't tell people that much. So I didn't really understand that bottom part, but that's post-traumatic winning, right?
That is. And that is in its most profound sense. I mean, and that is the final part. I mean, the first part of it is, you know, I believe it's kind of the post-traumatic growth part, is that this is difficult, but there is a way through it. And I know other people have it worse than me, you know, and I begin to study and whatnot, and I begin to grow. From the experience, and so, but post-traumatic winnings doesn't stop there, you know. That my whole thing about, oh yeah, hooray for fucking you, Bev. Like, we don't really care that you grow. What does that have? What does that mean for the rest of us? What does that mean for the team? What does that mean for the community? Yeah. And to me, that is the magical piece in all of this. And when you begin to all of a sudden look outward and say, I could probably help that person, ease that person's burden, I can do that. To me, that is almost the amen statement. I know it's not the final piece, but once somebody experiences that, explain to me what did it feel like when you got to that point?
Like a peace. I don't fuss over food. It's a non-issue. I just feel peaceful. And when I get excited about something, the world is going to hear about it. And when I started listening to All Marine Radio, that's why my nurse had heard about you, because, you know, I would be saying things that I had heard up until then. And then she said,
for the love of God, I hope you don't curse like I do.
I can. Oh. I know how to, but I don't usually.
Good.
Unless somebody gets on my wrong side.
Well, then they've earned it. That's their problem.
Yes, yes. And then they earn it. So it's just a feeling of peace. And my friends will say, like, why don't you? I said, no. I said, I just don't fuss over those things anymore. I still don't like my physical situation where I am, but I can't do anything about that. All I can control is the food that I put in my mouth, whether I exercise, and control my mind. I can't control anything else that's happening around.
So, but you've lost weight. You're proud of that.
Yeah. Since I stopped teaching, oh man, I had just grown so, well, I had gained, you know, one of the things I say to people is, like, don't go on diets. I mean, you've got to have a lifestyle change, and I didn't before then. Now I do. I've totally changed I don't fuss over food, and it feels so good because it's not an issue. And whenever you, especially people that are obese, it's a disease. They know now that your brain and one of your glands, they want you to be a certain weight. And I guess that explains why some people don't gain weight their whole life. They stay sort of the same number, go up and down 20 pounds. Well, if you don't fit into that mold, if you lose 20 pounds, you're probably going to gain it back plus another 10%. Okay. So, I mean, over years, you keep 10 pounds on every year. I won't tell you the number I started at. I have told that to my friends, and that was hard to get out, but I did. But since I quit teaching, now that's been 18 years now. Man, I'm old. I have gotten rid of 154 pounds.
And holy shit.
Now, because of the lymphedema, and lymphedema is a condition where the lymphatic vessels don't work properly, so your body retains fluids.
Right.
So, you know, our body is a big percentage of water. So that water counts against you when you're jumping on the scale, and it counts for you when you get rid of it. So I've done that, but since I started listening to All Marine Radio, it would be 100 pounds.
Yes. Because,
yes. And, well, 34 of that was the compression wrapping that literally had to squeeze it out.
Hey, don't screw us over on the stats, okay? What's up with that?
I know.
Don't. We get our number, whatever the footnotes are, screw that, okay? Don't knock my number down.
I know, and you deserve it, because I know where I would be if I hadn't discovered All Marine Radio. And I always think, how does something like that come into a person's life? Like, if I hadn't discovered that,
Somebody trying to rip somebody off, I think. That's how that
I
happened.
I guess, and my curiosity. But
no, you know what? Again, we all see all kinds of stuff every day. And mm-hmm. I know I do. And there'll be things that I'll see, and I'll be inquisitive about, and I'll go and I'll begin that process of investigation. I think it happens because you're an inquisitive person. I mean, I'm just listening to you talk and the different jobs you've got, and whether it's volunteering for the RCMP, or whether it's being the secretary president of the Adult Hockey League, you're inquisitive. And I think it happens when you are inquisitive. You see things and you kind of pick that scab, or you follow that thing. And it could have been not a good thing, and you would have shut it off and moved on to other things. But let me ask you this, Bev. You've turned your focus outwards now.
Yes. Oh, yes. And, it started first when my friends would come in, and I was thinking today, I wonder if they think when they walk in, it's like, oh, what's Bev going to talk about next? Because I just fell in love with this post-traumatic winning and everything. And
how could you not?
Helped me so much.
How could you
not? I know. And you have to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how could you not? When somebody starts talking about their woes, I mean, and look, if there's somebody that should be overdosed on it and say, you know, I'm so over that shit, it should be me. Mm-hmm. But I'm not. Last night, I was sitting here. I'm doing a much more detailed script so that when I film myself doing the presentation, and you've seen the presentation, that's me narrating it from a desk. So mm-hmm. the next version of it will be me actually doing it. And so there's a difference between when I do it live and it's not acted. But it's not a benign event. It's not a narrated. And then we walked down the trail and we saw the bunny. It's like, it's not like that. It is me, right? Just bringing you this thing that I've lived and with all these people that I've crossed paths with, from Stacy Falzerano to my friend Tim to Matt Kiker to Dave Furness to all these different people that are the fabric of what post-traumatic winning is. And so the me doing it is different. In fact, Tim Lentz told me, he said, listening to you narrate it, he said, it's different. He goes, you got to get yourself in front of a camera and you got to do this. I said, I know I will. So anyway, in order for me to do that, right, I don't have a teleprompter, but I do have PowerPoint and I can control that as a prompter, so to speak. And so there'll be a script on it, right? And the script mm-hmm. bulletized, but I had to make I have a script now that's 19 pages long.
Okay? Oh, wow.
Yeah. There are 195 different slides in the presentation. And on every one of them now is detailed points because, and Bev's seen it, so I think you could vouch for this. I mean, the density of post-traumatic winning because of all these different experiences is amazing. I mean, it is a deep, deep thing to watch and to all the different stories and anecdotes and all these things, the different audio and the video. I want to say there's close to 35 different audio and video cuts in it now. And and so to do it justice is important, and so I'm building that script. So I'm up last night at about 11 o'clock or maybe a little bit earlier, maybe it's been about 9. And I get an email from somebody on the East Coast. Hey, Chaplain Umptyfrats just sent me an email. My husband committed suicide X number of years ago. He's a Marine. And he said that I should contact you in order to watch your presentation. And I said, well, by all means. Imagine sitting there just minding your own business. Jack and Joe are racked out, snoring or something. And I'm kind of doing my thing. And in the middle of this, you have this heart-piercing ray of sunshine come into your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this thing has been. So if there's anybody who ought to be over it, it's me. But I am the person that's most addicted to it because of the way this thing continues to impact my life, dare I say, on a daily basis.
Right.
So, yeah, you don't have to convince me, girlfriend. I'm like, I'm fucking with you.
Oh, right? Man, I'm addicted to talking about it, and I wish
I could. And let me tell you this. I think your friends would certainly vote with their feet. If they were like, ugh, Bev is insufferable with that shit, they would vote with their feet. They would not come back.
No.
But just as, you know, initially it's seed planting, and then it's reflection from the seed planting, and then it's kind of an inquisitiveness, and then it's something else from the seed planting. And then all of a sudden, the wires touch, and there's a spark. And now you pretty much get out of their way and let them investigate it. Because mm-hmm. the great motivator is living with this shit.
Right.
That is the great motivator. And then all of a sudden, somebody like you, Bev, is showing them that there is a path. It does exist. You can walk it. And I'm sure they're like, Jesus Christ, Bev has lost her mind, right? And then they watch what you're doing. They hear, like, just like you're, you know, the girl, like, something's mm-hmm. different about you. What's going on? You know? And I mean, and that stuff is profound when people see that who know you. So keep going. So
okay.
Your friends.
Oh yeah, my friends. But because of the lymphedema and my leg was getting larger and larger, my nurse had suggested that I have it wrapped with this compression wrapping, and we'd get the fluid out of it, and then I could be the wearer for the rest of my life of these ugly compression stockings.
Yes.
And I kind of fought it because I said, what would I have? Could it be done at home? No, you'd have to go into the nursing home into respite because there are offices there. And I said, so how long? Well, maybe 3 weeks. Well, it ended up being, I went in last year, June 17th, and I was in part of the week, and my last day was August 29th. So I spent the summer in the nursing home. But man, the number of people that I could talk to about post-traumatic winning was amazing. So the leg did come down, and in order to put the compression stocking on you, and I think I sent you a picture of what my leg looked like, the size of it. Mm-hmm. It is amazing. And we started wrapping it on the 18th of June. We were actually FaceTiming with the person that, or the nurse that had shown Tina how to do it. She was from Newfoundland. She went to a session on this to learn because she said, Bev, I want to help you some way. We've got to do something with your leg. So they start. So you weigh first because they need to know how much fluid will come out. I also had to see a vascular surgeon because when you're dumping a lot of fluids like this, this lymphatic fluid, it can be very hard on your kidneys. And on September 8th, he said, no, you're good to go. He said, your kidneys are all right. So okay, we'll do this. Well, you can't just wrap it tight because you could wreck the leg. So each time you rewrapped it, like every day it was it was only done twice a week wrapping. Then you added a bit more compression. The first time it was on the Tuesday, and on the Friday morning, of course, the wrappings came off, and before they wrapped me again, they weighed, and there were 13 pounds of that fluid had come off.
Wow.
Which is amazing, but thankfully, I was right across the bathroom in the room because, like, I mean, in 3 days, like, to dump that much fluid, I'd go for, like, 36 hours, and you might be once every hour. Because you had to get rid of this fluid was going off. So that's why I say the fluid counts for you and against you. And then they would measure the leg and in four spots. Well, my leg was so grotesque, like as they said, like, where is your ankle? Like, where are we going to measure for your ankle? So my nurse, she put black marks on my leg and she says, well, maybe your ankle will be here. Well, it actually, she got it quite, she was lucky because then there were four areas that they measured. And when two different measuring times, your measurements were pretty well the same. That was the indication that the body wasn't going to reduce it anymore. And that was July 25th. And at that time, then in comes a person that is trained in measuring for the compression stockings. And he came from the city and he measured my leg. And then compression stockings get ordered, and they're actually made in Germany.
So compression stockings are custom made?
Yes. You can buy them over the counter, you know, like at a pharmacy.
Right.
But the compression of those are about 15 or 16. I don't quite understand the numbers. But mine have to be 30 to 40.
Got it.
And I said to to Randy when he was measuring, I said, well, mine are the heaviest. He said, Bev, there's some people that have to wear 60 compression. I think 40.
Wow.
Yeah, so they get custom made. Mine is made up to my thigh, above my knee. It has to be because the compression made a difference and it took it off of my whole body because it was moving it off of that leg and it made a difference. And Tina, one day she said, even your butt went down, Bev. Anyway, so I stayed there. I said, well, you don't work on the weekend, no. So I said, how about if you wrap me Monday And then I will come in Sunday nights, wrap me Monday, and then rewrap on Thursday, and then I'll go home for the weekend. So that's why I had to pay for the room the whole time, but I was only, you know, at least I got the weekend away from that place.
Right.
But while I was in there, of course, I had to basically stay in my room because there was a respiratory issue there at that time, and they were trying to protect me from getting it. So I stayed in my room, and people just flocked to me. You know, they came in because I'm a social person.
Right.
I like to talk.
Sure.
And a lot of them I already knew. And so then I started talking. I was reading the Viktor Frankl book at that time.
Right.
And I started talking then about All Marine Radio, like I have it on, and post-traumatic winning. And I was really surprised. I remember one nurse, and we were talking, and then she started to walk out the room, and then she came back and she said, you know, Langenberg, where I was, is a German community. I mean, Kaiser Wilhelm is the main road through their town. And she stopped and she came back and she says, you know, Mom, her mother, like she came from Germany. And she said, you know, my mom never talked a lot about it, but so it made people think about their life. One person said, yeah, my son died. You know, so they would open up to me. So I would just tell them more. And then when I got home,
isn't that amazing? I mean,
I know.
Here you're,
it
you
is.
Know, we were talking about General Furness doing it.
Yeah.
He does it after watching, you know, us talk about our lives.
Yeah.
And he's the kind of guy that he's a leader. He brought me there. He brought us there that week. You know, hopefully to make a difference. And, but again, unanticipated that, and again, that's where the first commandment comes from. Don't fake it, because it started out as two goals and eight commandments. And one of the two additional commandments is the first one, don't fake it. And that comes from the power of the response because you didn't fake it. And what's interesting, and it echoes even today, because I was, you know, talking to my friend Tim, and I can't remember who else. It was somebody else because they had identical experiences. So terrified for so long, if I tell my family that I've been raped, what are they going to think of me? Will they shun me? And then the response is 180 degrees out, you know, and all she feels is their love and their tenderness and their compassion. And, but that's not what you know, we're all nervous when we do it, right? Well, what's everybody going to say? And then your experience is 180 degrees out. But it's just amazing. And then they come and, you know, when you unburden yourself, you give them permission to do the same. And isn't it amazing the number of people that will walk up and share stuff with you that you just sit there and go, holy shit.
Yes, like in there. Now because I'm in my house, well, of course, COVID came along, so my bubble is small. So I don't get to contact many people that way. But like in there, yeah, it was amazing. And I had a friend, she ended up being in there, and her son pushed her into my room. She was in a wheelchair the first day, and my nurse had made two signs to put on the wall, and one was, it's words that I had told her. I had read them somewhere, and it said, get comfortable being uncomfortable.
Right.
And, I mean, I wasn't comfortable sharing anything about myself, so I had to get comfortable with, you know, sort of that feeling. And the other one was, strive for progress, not perfection. Now, when that friend was pushed into my room, and her husband was there, and you could see, like, it's, I mean, she was crying. She didn't want to have to be a resident there.
Right.
And I said to her, look at this sign. And I said, you have to do what I've had to do here. We have to get comfortable being uncomfortable. I mean, you have to accept that that's the way it is. I'm a like a black and white person, you know, like, you know, that's the way it is. And I noticed her in that time. The first little while, she sort of went by my room. But then it started like every day she would come into my room. And when her husband came in the afternoon, they would come in and we would sit and talk. And I noticed the change in her. She was more comfortable being uncomfortable and sharing things about herself. So that's a part that I miss, not being able to be out and about.
Well,
but maybe by next year I'll get out and about.
Right. So as we wind this thing down, Bev,
yep.
What advice would you give people? You know, here our relationship is the most improbable relationship. Probably that I have, that I've made. Nancy, very much the same, though. Hears about mm-hmm. Allmarine Radio and somehow or other finds it, and it resonates with her. For people that have yet to touch somebody else's life with the things that are resonant in post-traumatic winning, what would you tell them?
Oh, I mean, just go for it. It doesn't hurt to try. Like, share about yourself if you can do it. And, people will just start talking about theirs. And of course, the ones that are in my life, I say, like, I always give them a copy of the post-traumatic winning, or of the 3 and 10. And it was just last week, a friend, when she came, and we were talking that day, and she was going into her daughter's works at the nursing home. And I said, oh, I've got two run off. I said, I want you to take to her and another friend. Well, I don't know. I said, yes, give it to them because they're touching so many lives themselves.
Right.
So it's just like, you know, my advice is don't be like Bev for so many years that I didn't want to burden somebody with my issues, and start talking about yourself. And I always say, listen to Allmarine Radio. And if you're not interested in the military stuff, like, listen to the post-traumatic winning things.
No, and yeah, there's normally enough stuff that you'll find something that will you should, I should probably use you as a consultant, because the next phase of all of this is the posttraumaticwinning.com website is going to change. I will probably, you know, by the domain name T2J. So the letter,
okay.
The letter T, the number 2, and J.
Trauma to joy?
So a very short mm-hmm. way of it will have a YouTube channel. But resident there will not be all the military stuff.
Right.
It will just be a place to go to come to discover about the concepts resident in post-traumatic winning and how that you can go from trauma to joy. So I should probably use your expertise in terms of compiling the content that should migrate from one website, because everything isn't applicable. And what I've tried to do with posttraumaticwinning.com is to make it something that's not as military. And so it's not, maybe some people find that intimidating or alienated, and I certainly don't want to miss an opportunity to touch somebody's life because of something like that. So I will probably, here in the next couple months, ask you to help with that. But, I think there's phases to this. I think the first is you hear something that you find interesting. I think the second phase is, you know, if you're an inquisitive person, or for most of us, we've just been in that darkness for such, and it's such a lonely, bad place. And then all of a sudden, somebody flickers a light in there, and then you know, and the thing with post-traumatic winning is it's not an encouraging thing. It's there's a path. It exists as sure as I'm talking today to you. And if you want to walk it, you can walk it. Well, that's not the way most of these things go. Most of these things are encouraging, and you know you can deal. You know, this
yeah,
and
right.
That's not exactly. and I don't think you know the. I think we're practical, everyday people. I think that are, you know, trying to deal with it on their own, and I think that's the way most people wind up dealing with it. You hear these things, and you're like, "Geez, I," And then they bump into somebody like you, or somebody like you brings them there, and they learn that this is what has had such a profound effect on her. Mm-hmm. Holy smokes. And I know her. She's kind of a no bullshit girl, right? Right? I mean, that's part of, that's part of the credibility of it.
Yes.
And then it goes from there. If they'll just consider it, I think it's so powerful. Like I said, all the fabric that's been woven with all these different stories and all these things that are fundamentally true. It's just really exciting. And first of all, I can't thank you enough today, Beth, for coming on and sharing, you know, your story with everybody. And I know that you're going to inspire people to take maybe a step they haven't taken in their life so far. But I wanna thank you because to me, what's the coolest part of your story is how you have begun impacting the lives of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, there's different phases to post-traumatic winning, and when somebody finally does turn that corner and begins to touch the lives of other people, to me, that's when they actually, you know, they wear the mantle of I am a post-traumatic winner. Because mm-hmm. is there any feeling in the world like touching somebody else's life?
Oh my gosh, no. And I think I've done that all my life, even from a kid when I'd go visit my grandma and then I visit four other grandmas in the neighborhood and you know, they put up with me, but I think it probably brightened their day that somebody stopped in for a few minutes.
You bet. You bet. But, and again, I think this is a little bit different in that the blackness is so black in this part of the world, mm-hmm. right? And when you can, when you can be somebody's guide to take them out of that place, I think that's truly, truly a special thing. Mm-hmm. The last thing I want to ask you about is you sent me an email a few weeks ago. You talked to a member of the Saskatchewan legislature. And,
yes.
So I hope you continue to bend that guy's ear. Tell everybody, well, you don't need to mention names, but tell everybody that little story.
Well, right now I can't bend the ear. Well, I contacted him and I sent him an email and he phoned me in because he lives in town, like that's where his residence is. And I was asking about things that pertain to me and it had to do with the lymphedema and compression stockings and, you know, coughs and that. And then he happened to say, well, then I don't know how I started, but I just always seem to gravitate to speaking about post-traumatic winning. And he said to me that he was responsible for all the first responders in the province. And then, well, what I was talking about, would that, you know, would that work for them? And I said, yeah, well, I think I used the word definitely in capitals in the email. And then he mentioned also, because his portfolio is northern Saskatchewan, rural, and then the first responders. And then he mentioned about the First Nations, and I guess the ones that he had been in contact with, that they say, you know, we get people in, and nothing seems to change. But the part that I think in, you know, where you have to, you know, sort of have a mentor, I don't know if, you know, they need to, they're going to have to, if they follow this, then they're going to have to maybe help each other out. And I, you know, I don't know enough about the First Nations, but so I said that to him and that was sort of the end of our conversation. Well, then, Saskatchewan decides to call an election and he had told me that he said, when the writ comes down, he said, I have to go black out because he said, I can't, you know, I can't be communicating other than election things. So they called the election, and the election in Saskatchewan is for the 26th of October. Now, the party that's been in for the last 12 years is if they get back in, and hopefully he gets back in, I can't see that not happening, but his portfolio may change. But then I guess I could still communicate with him and say, well, whoever's doing it, maybe, you know, clue them in as to what's going on.
Well, let me tell you, most of the time, all these different things, these initiatives, Mm-hmm. They start with a conversation that migrates mm-hmm. to a second conversation. So
yes.
I just think that's very exciting. And I told Bev, you know, would it help the First Nation people of Canada? Absolutely it would. And they in turn, sure. they in turn would be able to communicate that to other First Nation organizations across mm-hmm. Canada. And they would be a leader in this, as well as the first responders in Northern Saskatchewan would turn around and tell other unions and other in other provinces and other parts of Saskatchewan itself. And then they would begin, you know, to start something like this and begin to be consumers of post-traumatic winning and be leaders in that change, because there's no doubt in my mind that we can do it. Because it's too real, it's too good, and there's too much data now associated with it, and so now it's just a question of getting it out there. So don't screw that up.
I heard that. Well, we'll see what happens with it. And I had just before we finished, I had the church fire chief's wife had helped measure my leg for, because I'm getting moccasins made for myself.
Nice.
Other ones. And I thought, oh, she's coming over. I have to run off enough 3 and 10s for the fire, our local fire department, and her husband, who is still, he's been fire chief for like 39 years, I think, whatever. But he's also the president of the Saskatchewan Association of yeah. Fire Chiefs. So I ran them off for her, and she looks at one, and she said, oh my gosh, I need one of these for my son. I said, I have it for you there too, because three sons do volunteer fire, but one's also an EMT.
Aye.
And so I ran that off, and then she said, you know, and then I put a note with it to just sort of explain a little bit. And I said, she said, you know what? They have a meeting tomorrow night, because they meet once a week and, you know, practice different skills. So she said, I'm going to take this stuff to the meeting. I haven't heard anything from them because everything sort of got shut down with COVID.
Right.
But what I want to do is when you get things ready that we can purchase, then I want to purchase. I don't know how you do it with, you know, with an organization, like give them access to your
right.
program.
Right.
But I know myself, I want to purchase that for them, because there was three or four years ago, one of them, the young ones, he committed suicide.
Yeah, and you know that suicide's one statistic. Alcoholism is another,
oh,
right?
Yes.
Divorce, domestic violence, all
yep.
with, I don't know what to do with this stuff. It affects me. I lose my shit sometimes.
Yep.
I self-medicate. And again, having lived in North Dakota, the liquor problem that exists
–
right?
I know.
Right? That is just part of the culture, and has been part of the culture for decades and decades and decades and decades, probably centuries.
And it will never stop.
And it just makes everything worse.
Yeah.
It makes everything worse. So we have work to do. So as I said before,
yes.
don't screw it up.
Yes, sir.
Well, Bev, first of all, thank you for doing this.
Well, thanks, Matt.
It's a wonderful piece about you personally, and this will not be the last time you come on, because you have a good sense of humor. So we will at some point do this again. I hope you don't mind if I bother you and say, hey, would you come back on and talk about this? It'd be interesting to have your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope you don't mind doing that.
No.
And thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Well,
much.
Let me ask you one more question. Is there anything that I haven't been smart enough mm-hmm. to ask you that you want to say to everybody?
Oh, I think we've covered most everything. I can't think of it. I will think of it once we're off.
Of course. No, that's by the way, that's the correct answer. That's actually.
I know.
That's a true.
I've listened to all these interviews, so I know where things go.
That's the right question.
I can match
right
you with
answer.
Sarcasm, Mac.
There you go. All right. Thank you. More of Almarine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.